Well, welcome to the first class of our new quarter. We will again be having to do these simply audio and not in person, but I hope that everyone is benefiting from these. I hope that you will follow along carefully in your Bible, that you will get a copy of the lesson material and utilize that. I want to begin, as we always do with our memory passages, but this quarter I'm going to cut them down. I've included everything we've done so far in the lesson material, but in class, I've only picked out a few of these that we're going to go over. I would encourage you, at home, go over all of them. But Genesis 12, 1 through 3, "Now the Lord had said to Abram, 'Get out of your country, from your family and from your father's house, to a land that I will show you. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse him who curses you. And in you, all the families of the earth shall be blessed.'" As we have been tracing the story of the Bible from Genesis now up to 1 Samuel, we have seen God keep that promise to make out of the descendants of Abraham this great nation, to give them that land that he had shown him, the land of Canaan. And so what we're waiting on as we follow through the rest of the Old Testament story is the blessing of all families. That will take place, of course, in Christ. Exodus 19:5, when God had brought them to Mount Sinai, he said, "Now therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be a special treasure to me above all people, for all the earth is mine." In so many ways, the story of the Old Testament is the story of what might have been if Israel had simply kept the covenant, listened to the voice of God, they could have received so many more blessings. Leviticus 11:45, here is the calling of Israel, and in many ways, we can say the same calling for us, 1 Peter 1. "For I am the Lord who brings you up out of the land of Egypt to be your God. You shall therefore be holy, for I am holy." Another one, Deuteronomy 6:5, illustrates the principle we've been driving at. The law of God changed from the Old Testament to the New Testament, but the same principles of faith and obedience, they continue. And it's an obedience from the heart. Deuteronomy 6:5, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength." What happened in the book of Judges? Well, they didn't obey the voice of God. They didn't keep his covenant. They didn't love him with their heart, soul, and strength. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. It was the problem then, and so often is the problem today. Now, our new passage that we'll add is from 1 Samuel 12:24-25. And it's looking ahead a few lessons to when God has given them a king. But it says, "Only fear the Lord and serve him in truth with all your heart. For consider what great things he has done for you. But if you still do wickedly, you shall be swept away, both you and your king." 1 Samuel 12:24-25. As we're beginning this new quarter and this new book, if you think back to, we've used sometimes the 17 points of the Bible story. And last quarter we were looking at the invasion and conquest of Canaan. We looked at the period of the judges. Well, when we come to Samuel, Samuel is really the bridge between that period of the judges and the period of the United Kingdom. He will serve as the last judge of Israel, but he will also be the one to anoint the first two kings of Israel. And I also want to think about, and I'll say a little more about this as we go along, the book of Judges ended with five, what we divided into five chapters, these two stories that we said, you know, in some ways were appendices of the book. They illustrate the principle that everyone was doing what was right in their own eyes. But as far as the judges themselves went, it ended with Samson. And the way the book of 1 Samuel opens, I think it is intended to make us think back to Samson and to connect with that last judge of the book of Judges, who was a mighty warrior, but a very obviously flawed judge. As you read 1 Samuel, 2 Samuel, in this quarter we're going to cover the first 11 chapters of 1 Kings. Let me give you some thoughts on how to read the book. How to read. You know, look at the words and try to understand them, obviously that. But these are what's part of what's called the books of history. And we need to appreciate the events that are taking place as we move from 12 relatively independent, largely self-governing tribes to a united nation under one central governing authority. That's very important. But when you think about these books, I think one of the things that you ought to focus on, not just seeing as the story moves forward, but think about the characters involved in these. Some of the best character studies you will ever do can be found in these books. People like Hannah, Eli, Samuel, Saul, Jonathan, David, Joab, Absalom, Solomon. These people make for very, sometimes inspirational studies as we see people of faith and courage. They also sometimes serve as great warnings as we see sometimes people who start out good go very wrong. A lot of great things. We'll talk about those as we go through. But I would encourage you, think about these on your own. Develop these further. One of the great values of this section we're going to be studying is on several occasions, the Lord will illustrate to Israel how indeed they could be His special people if they would just obey Him. What happens when people of faith and faithfulness trust in the power of God? Samuel would lead them to a great victory and raise the Ebenezer, the stone of help. David will defeat Goliath. The borders of Israel will be expanded. The temple will be built. There are some great accomplishments. But on the flip side of that, in these books, the consequences of sin are really made to stand out. And when we get to the story of David, we will see even forgiven sin can have very serious consequences. If you've got your material, you notice in number one, I pointed out that the first few chapters are the continuation of the period of the judges. During the period of the judges, the worship of God is corrupted. There is so much darkness. Many have turned to idols. But just as we saw in the book of Ruth, there were bright spots. There were good people. In chapter 2 of 1 Samuel, the writer is, and by the way, we don't know with any certainty who the writer of this book is. It's named after Samuel because he is the key character at the beginning of it. But he obviously is not the author of this because he dies before the events of 2 Samuel even take place. But whoever God chose to be this author, in the second chapter, he's going to show us how the corruption reached even to the sacrifices at the tabernacle with Hophni and Phinehas. It was a bad time. But in this dark, evil age, there was Hannah, a woman of faith. And while Elkanah, her husband, was not a perfect man, he had taken the two wives, he seems to be a man of faith, one who would worship the Lord. So, like Ruth, bright spots in a dark time. All right, do you have your Bible open? 1 Samuel chapter 1. It opens up. Now there was a certain man of Ramathaim Zophim of the mountains of Ephraim, and his name was Elkanah, the son of Jeraham, the son of Elihu, the son of Tohu, the son of Zuth, an Ephraimite. Starts off introducing us to Elkanah. And it tells about him being from the mountains of Ephraim. It says, an Ephraimite. Now, there are some versions, instead of Ephraimite, say Ephrathite. And that could tie into Bethlehem, which is sometimes referred to as Bethlehem Ephrathah. But these geographical notes, and that's what they are, they're not his family lineage. 1 Chronicles 6, and I believe it's verses 33 and 34, tell us that he was a Levite. Samuel is of Levitical descent, not of the tribe of Ephraim. They simply resided in that. Now, it makes mention in verse 2. He had two wives. The name of one was Hannah. The name of the other, Peninnah. Well, one of the things I see in this that I think is a good takeaway is, without explicitly condemning it, as the Bible so often does, it shows us when men depart from the one man, one woman pattern that was set forth in the very beginning, it brings adverse consequences. And we will see that take place in this. And it goes on to tell us of the two wives. Peninnah had children, but Hannah had no children. That sets us up for what's going to happen. Well, each year it speaks of how that he would go from his city to worship and sacrifice to the Lord of hosts in Shiloh. Shiloh seems to have been pretty much the permanent holding place for the tabernacle from shortly after the conquest until now. The maps I included in this quarter's material don't actually have the location of Shiloh on them. But if you look back to last quarter's maps, you will see the location of Shiloh. Or if you look at this quarter's map and you imagine the spot that's about halfway between Bethel and Shechem, that's where Shiloh was. You know, just so you kind of have an idea of where this was. They would go up to worship. And verse 3 introduces us to Hophni and Phinehas and then leaves them. It won't come back to them until chapter 2 and tell us a lot more about them. But when they came to make their offering, it talks about how Elkanah gave portions to his wives. Remember our studies from Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers. Except for the burnt offering, most sacrifices were not totally consumed on the altar. And the peace offerings, the thanksgiving offerings, these were largely consumed by the one making the offering. And so when you came up to sacrifice, it was also a time of enjoying the blessings of God in this meal. And to Hannah, it says, verse 5, he would give a double portion. He loved her, even though the Lord had closed her womb. But the rival wife, she provoked her. She made her miserable. You can just sort of use your imagination and picture the kinds of things that she may have said as her and her children are eating. And yes, of course, Elkanah has given her some special food because she has no children. And it just, every year, she was provoked. And she wept, did not eat, it says verse 7. Well, Elkanah tried. Verse 8, Hannah, why do you weep? Why do you not eat? And why is your heart grieved? Am I not better to you than 10 sons? You know, he gives her his best shot. I love you. I don't care that you've not provided me with sons. You know, can't you take comfort in me? But it wasn't enough. And she gets up after she's finished eating and drinking. And picture this. She goes and there is Eli, the high priest. He's sitting in a seat, it says, by the doorpost of the tabernacle of the Lord. And he's watching. He, imagine him observing the various worshipers. Verse 10, there is another little tie into the book of Ruth. It says, she was in bitterness of soul. The word bitterness, it's that Hebrew word mara. Remember Naomi coming back to Bethlehem and saying, don't call me Naomi, which meant pleasant. Said, call me Mara, which meant bitter. It was the word that Israel had given to the water when they came out of Egypt. She said, it says that she was in bitterness of soul. She prayed to the Lord. She wept in anguish. She goes to God in prayer and she makes a vow. She makes a promise to God. She said, O Lord of hosts, if you will indeed look on the affliction of your maidservant and remember me and not forget your maidservant, but will give your maidservant a male child, then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and no razor shall come upon his head. Now, immediately, our mind ought to be going back to Samson. The birth of Samson was foretold by the angel. And the angel said, no razor to come upon his head. The last judge of the book of Judges. We open up the book of 1 Samuel. And we have not the angel this time, but the woman saying, if you give me a son, no razor will come upon his head. She makes no mention of the grape. She does not specifically use the word Nazarite, but the not cutting the hair at all was connected with the Nazarite vow. She's saying, he will be the Lord's. And I would think the chronology of Samson and Samuel, their births are not too far apart. I talked before about believing that Samson comes near the end of the book of Judges, around the same time as Samuel. So, you know, we've got him going to be like Samson, except he won't be like Samson. He will be very different. But the story has a little interesting twist. She is praying fervently. She's crying. She's in that bitterness and anguish of soul. And Eli looks over and he sees this sobbing woman whose mouth is moving. Her lips are moving, but nothing's coming out of it. And he erroneously concludes that she is drunk. And he goes to her and he says to her, verse 14, how long will you be drunk? Put your wine away from you. Almost as if he's saying, don't you come in here defiling this holy place, which is very ironic when we come to the next chapter and we see how his sons are behaving. But Eli rebukes her, but she immediately protests and says, no. I am sorrowful, but I've not drunk wine or intoxicating drink. I've poured out my soul before the Lord. I'm not one of the wicked women. Verse 16 says, we begin to see this expression, sons of Belial. to refer to wicked men. Here is a daughter of Belial. She said, I'm not one of those daughters of Belial, one of those wicked people. I've just poured out my heart in grief. And you know Eli had to have felt bad then. Well, he turned and he blessed her and said, go in peace. And the God of Israel grant your petition which you have asked of him. And she said, let your maidservant find favor in your sight. And notice what said next. Having poured out her heart to God and having received the blessing of God's high priest, she was no longer sad. She went and ate. She believed that if the priest had given his blessing as the representative of God, things would happen. So the next morning they got up early, they worshiped, and they went home. Elkanah knew his wife, and the Lord remembered her. When the Bible uses the word remembered of God, it doesn't mean that he had forgotten. But it is draws attention to a special notice he takes of someone, of something. And he caused her to conceive and bear a son, and she named him Samuel. You know, we just say Samuel, but we need to learn, especially with proper names, to see when that E-L is at the end of a word or the beginning, almost always it is a reference to God. Samuel, Israel, Israel, a prince of God. Samuel, heard by God. She named him, gave him a name that would forever be a reminder that her prayer had been answered. Well, the time came to go up to Shiloh again, and Elkanah is, you know, getting the family, and Hannah says, no, I want to wait until my son is ready, he's weaned, and he's ready to stay. The law did not require the women to appear before the Lord. It talked about the males appearing. So, you know, she could do this. How long does she wait? She stayed and nursed her son until she had weaned him. There are a couple of thoughts here. One, Bob Waldron in his book suggests that the word weaning is used in the Bible sometimes to mean a little more than simply the child is no longer nursing, but that it has the idea of a certain amount of maturity and independence. You know, not talking teenage years, but you know, 3 or 4 years old, where the child is at least on its own and able to go. I have seen several sources that just state, as a matter of fact, the Jewish women nursed their babies for 3 years, and the source is the apocryphal book, 2 Maccabees. 2 Maccabees, I believe it was chapter 7, makes reference to a woman pleading with her son not to compromise his faith, and she makes reference to the fact, I nursed you for 3 years. 2 Maccabees is talking about an event that took place in the 2nd century B.C. Perhaps in the 11th century B.C., women were doing the exact same thing they were doing in the 2nd century B.C. But to me, to say, well, this was the Jewish custom based on something that happens 900 years later, that's too great an extrapolation for me. I'm only mentioning that to say, when you read somebody say, well, the custom then was, make sure you read carefully. I don't know what the custom was in the 11th century. 2 Maccabees, which is not an inspired book, but is a historical book, gives me some insight into the 2nd century. But 900 years is a long time. That's a big gap. So, Learn to be discerning in your reading of things like that. But however long she kept him, one thing that you need to make sure you don't miss is Elkanah, Samuel is his firstborn child by this wife he loves. And he says to her, verse 23, do what seems best to you. Wait until you have weaned him. Only let the Lord establish his word. He was fully supportive of the vow she had taken. And when the time came, verse 24, she had weaned him. She took him up with her with three bulls, one ephah of flour, and a skin of wine. She brought him to the house of the Lord in Shiloh. And he is still quite young. And that's the point is made in verse 24. In verse 26, she brings him to Eli. It had been a few years. And she said, oh, my Lord. Oh, and this is not Lord as God. This is Lord as Master, Sir. Oh, my Lord, as your soul lives, my Lord, I am the woman who stood by you here praying to the Lord, praying to Yahweh. For this child I prayed, and the Lord has granted me my petition, which I ask of him. Therefore, I also have lent him to the Lord. As long as he lives, he shall be lent to the Lord. So they worshiped the Lord there. It's easy to be in a desperate situation like Hannah was in and make promises to God. Then when things are brighter, to reconsider those promises, to think differently. But give this woman of faith credit. She never backed away from that vow. I can't imagine what it was like for her. And not that she would never see him again, because it'll talk about later. They would come up yearly, and they may have had other visits. They didn't live that far away from him. But he would never live in her house again. He would be the Lord's. He would minister at the tabernacle. She kept her promise. God gave her a child, and she gave him to God. We'll stop here. The second and third chapters we will finish up for the Wednesday night class. But I have three takeaways I want to give to you. We've suggested some others. But when we find ourselves like Hannah, and sometimes we will find ourselves in anguish, that there, things are difficult, take it to the Lord in prayer. Cast your cares on him. He cares for you. No, he doesn't always give us the answer we want. But we have assurance that he cares. Take it to the Lord in prayer. And secondly, be a light in this dark world. The world is not getting brighter. As it dims and the darkness grows, it gives us an opportunity to shine even brighter. And then the last thing is, while we won't do it in the same way that Hannah did it, let's make sure that we dedicate our children to the service of the Lord. Parents, grandparents, there is nothing more important in the lives of your children than that they be given unto him. God, give us the strength to be godly people in a dark age who share that faith with our children, our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren.